Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and on Mission Control, we have Jay.
The Space Show, bringing the universe home to the Bayside, Wednesday evenings at 7 p.m.
On this evening's The Space Show, we commence a five-part series that addresses some of the key issues in Australia's policies towards the utilisation of space. Should Australia have its own space agency? Should we join the European Space Agency? Should we form some sort of regional space agency? Or should we continue, as we have done since the beginning of the space age some 60 years ago, to drift along without anybody to coordinate our space activities? And will changes occurring in the world's space industry force a decision on us? The last federal Labor government set out a satellite utilisation policy for Australia. The current coalition government adheres to that policy, if only because it hasn't gotten around to making its own policy. Although the last federal election had no immediate impact on policy, there are signs that the Turnbull government may soon set down new policy directions. But can a new policy make up for what Owen Mace sees as half a century of missed opportunities? Owen built the first Australian satellite right here in Melbourne. Alice Gorman of Flinders University, Adelaide, will bring us a potted history of Australia's involvement in space, giving a context to the current policy debate. If Australia won't join the European Space Agency, could individual Australian companies do so and reap the benefits of international collaboration? We will ask why New Zealand has a space agency while Australia does not. Can private ventures force the Australian government to act? Australian space activities are restricted by the United States' ITAR controls. We describe what ITAR is. Jason Held, the founder of the entrepreneurial company of Saber Astronautics, will bring an update assessment of Australian opportunities in space. He has clear ideas on how to develop our space industries. Melbournean Brett Beddington has views on why space is seen as a Northern Hemisphere activity. He has well-formed views on where Australian policies should be taking us. Mark Todd is right in the thick of the policy debate. He is the Senior Policy Officer in the Space Coordination Office in the Federal Department of Industry, Innovation and Science. From a Canberra viewpoint, he will describe the role played by his office and give hints of forthcoming policy changes. Russell Boyce is with the Australian Academy of Science. He looks towards a review of the Space Activities Act in the light of innovative, game-changing technologies. Russell is also working on the Academy's decadal plan for space science. This plan is due out this year. In a reprise appearance, Brett Beddington asserts that there is no bipartisan narrative about space. There is, he says, a growing interest in government in assuring Australian access to space and the critical infrastructure needed to give that assurance. Upali Davaskara is a PhD student at Monash University in Clayton. She likes to compare Elon Musk's vision with the box-ticking approach of the Australian government. Troy McCann was a member of the student group calling themselves Melbourne Space Program. He has some proposals for new space activities that will grow Australia's space sector. We will also look at the role of venture capital in promoting space developments. And just what are the differences between American and Australian approaches to space developments? A number of our guests on this five-part series will note the advent of milk carton-sized satellites, the so-called CubeSats, as revolutionary. And returning to the vexed issue of a space agency, we will ask what the cost of one would be.
The Space Show. More than just rocket science, we look at innovations, business practices and practical applications of space at 7 p.m. every Wednesday.
This documentary series on Australia's evolving space policies had been set to go to air last month when, lo and behold, the Space Industry Association of Australia issued a white paper. That paper called for the establishment of an Australian space agency. As a result, we postponed our program and rewrote our script to include this development. What was to have been a three-part series has now been expanded to five. In announcing the white paper, the chair of the Space Industry Association, Michael Davis, set out five reasons why he is calling for the formation of an Australian space agency.
One of the key questions is, well, why are we advocating this? And I'd just like to summarise what I see as the five key reasons for advocating a national space program of a permanent nature with an independent Australian space agency. The first is the creation of employment opportunities for Australians. Of course, in the space sector, we're talking about more sophisticated jobs involving considerable education and training, but also creating considerable economic benefit. And economic studies would suggest that people working in the space sector are able to generate more economic benefit than many other sectors. The second reason for advocating this are that apart from the direct economic benefits, there are spillover effects and benefits for the general economy, including the educational benefits point, which is that we want to inspire young Australians. And there is no better way to inspire young people to study hard subjects, the science, technology, engineering and maths, and to go on to university and study these disciplines than to interest them space exploration, space science, space engineering, and even space business, law, medicine, and economics. The fourth reason is the recognition and support of our international partners. And in many ways, this could be regarded as one of the most important reasons. Next, our international partners have a space agency of a similar nature to what we find in other countries, both large, medium-sized, and even smaller countries than Australia. It will be very, very difficult for us to progress with cooperation with those partners. And this is the reason why we are currently missing out on opportunity as a nation. The fifth reason is the confidence that as a nation, we have a greater control over the infrastructure and systems on which we rely for our national security.
Recent changes in the space industry and a call for the formation of an Australian space agency were made by Mark Ramsey. He's an advisory council member on the Space Industry Association of Australia, which is based in Adelaide.
Within the industry, I guess in the last decade, what we're seeing is quite a significant change in how the industry is structured and operating. And I guess we see at the SIA that the timing is aligning quite well to finally have the necessary discussions within Australia to consider how we can actually grow the space industry, and in particular how we can bring together a national space program and an Australian space agency. So turning to the white paper itself, what we found through the research is that Australia has around a 0.8% of the global space industry by some estimates. Given our share of the global economy is around 1.8%, we believe Australia is missing out and punching under its weight in the sector. The space industry itself is a highly dynamic and growing industry globally, with a growth rate of around 11%, which is significantly above most industries, and an industry size of about $330 billion US. once the domain of large nation states with big budgets. I guess most people typically think of NASA and landing on the moon when they think space. The industry has become agile and driven by commercial entrants. Particularly, we're seeing a lot of growth out of the technology sector and a lot of Silicon Valley startups at the moment. We're seeing the rise of entrants like SpaceX, Virgin Galactic, OneWeb and Amazon's Blue Origin. Satellites themselves are becoming relatively cheap to produce and launch, particularly with technology such as CubeSats. And as a side, Australia has 3 CubeSats launching in the next week or two, just as a representation of how quickly the industry is changing. Furthermore, in 2015, we saw global venture capital invested in space ventures that was more than the entire 15 years combined. So we're really seeing a lot of shifts in the industry, moving away from a large government-structured sector to far more of a start-up venture capital-type sector at the moment. And a reflection of that we're actually seeing in Australia, there's a number of new space start-up companies. In fact, I can hear a number of the names on the call who are new space startup companies, a number of whom are actually raising capital or have completed capital raises recently, and they're driving the creation of new jobs in the sector. So all of that considered, we believe it's time for Australia to embrace the industry to help drive economic growth whilst addressing national priorities through space technology. The white paper itself allowed us some examples into similar nations around the world, and particularly I would note the UK experience where they moved to a space agency model after many years of debating, similar to Australia. And the space agency there is certainly underpinned by an industry growth target perspective. The white paper itself also highlights the high dependence of the Australian economy on space-derived services and data, and how Australia has a vital national interest in maintaining our secure access to these space services and data. We also argue that a sovereign space capability is essential as geopolitics is becoming less certain globally at the moment. So what are we proposing within the white paper? We are proposing the Australian government should commit to a set of bold and ambitious growth targets. We've said in the short term, we should look at doubling the size of the industry within the next 5 years. It's bold but achievable. It would get us back to roughly parity of where we should be from an economic sense. And then we're proposing a longer-term target to capture 4% share of the world's market within 20 years. At that point, we would have a certainly vibrant industry and be starting to deliver on many of the things that Michael outlined before. In doing so, in setting these targets, we believe the government would signal strongly to the market that it intends to become a serious player in the industry, and that as a nation we'll move away from being a very passive consumer to one that's actively going to help shape the future of the space sector globally. It would also provide a rallying point for industry, driving growth in the sector, as well as, and Michael touched on it, delivering both spin-out and spin-in technologies from related industries such as defence, aerospace and science industries. To achieve all of this, we're proposing that Australia develops a national space program implemented and overseen by an Australian space agency, reporting directly to the Minister. In the white paper, we've started to actually progress the thinking a bit of what we believe an Australian Space Agency should be doing, the first of which is to address Australian national priorities through a national space program and driving industry growth. The second, as Michael touched on, it's very important that a space agency owns the international and legal aspects of the space domain through policy and law initiatives. And finally, as Michael alluded to, there would be nothing more inspiring for a young student who's thinking of going to a science path than to see that Australia is serious about inspiring our next generation through STEM and outreach efforts. Finally, we believe that the eyes of the space world will be watching the IAC 27 Congress that will happen in Adelaide in September, and the timing would be right for the Australian government to demonstrate its commitment to the sector at that Congress.
Last year, the Final Frontier Festival was held at Melbourne University by the Melbourne Space Program Group. The Space Show was there, and we recorded many of the speakers over the three-day program. One of the events was a panel discussion on the politics behind space in Australia. The panelists were introduced by Joel Patterson. He is an honours student in international politics at Monash University in Clayton.
So my name is Joel Patterson. I'm a Melbourne University alumnus and the International Security Fellow with Young Australians in International Affairs. And I've been asked to moderate the panel on the politics behind space today. So a little bit about myself. I'm a You know, have focused for the last couple of years on national security, the Australian Defence White Papers, other international security issues, and so that's kind of my background. Currently writing my honours thesis in counterinsurgency strategy and national security. Today we've got four extremely well-qualified panellists to be discussing the politics behind space, specifically in Australia, how that relates to our international treaties and relations, and our national security platforms. So first we've got Owen Mace. Owen Mace was part of the Australis Oscar 5 team and has graduated from the University of Melbourne with an electronics engineering degree and a PhD, and then became a lecturer in the Physics Royal Australian Air Force Department. He spent the second half of his working life in private industry and is now retired. Jason Held. Dr. Jason Held, founder of Sabre Astronautics, was a US Army major and Army Space Support team leader for US STRATCOM, formerly Space Command, and deployed internationally in support of military space missions. He was a lead instructor at the Inter-Service Space Fundamentals course, and he conducted flight software engineering for the Wide Field Camera 3 of the Hubble Space Telescope and testing for the International Space Station. At the University of Melbourne, he has founded Space Engineering Laboratory, provided leadership for the University CubeSat project, and Australia's first premixed rocket engine. Brett Biddington. Brett Biddington owns a space and cybersecurity consulting company and is leading the delivery team for the International Astronautical Congress in Adelaide in 2017. He's director of the Institute for Regional Security, a Canberra-based think tank, and also the Space Environment Research Cooperative Research Centre, or CERC. He holds adjunct professorial appointments at the Edith Cowan and RMIT universities and was admitted as a member of the Order of Australia for services to the Australian space sector in 2012. And finally, Warwick Holmes. Warwick has worked in Europe for 29 years designing, building, testing and launching spacecraft for the European Space Agency. Warwick has built 10 different spacecraft with a total mass successfully in orbit of 37 tonnes, including scientific, Earth observation, telecoms, interplanetary exploration, global navigation systems, and manned spacecraft programs, all valued at over $1 billion. Warwick has performed 5 launch campaigns from the ESA launch base using the Ariane 3, Ariane 4, Ariane 5, and Soyuz STB rockets. Can you please welcome all of them? So the format we're going to have is a 20 to 25 minute speech from each of our panellists, followed by about 45 minutes of questions.
Joe has just said, each panellist was given 20 minutes to set out their case before the event was opened to questions and comments from the audience. In all, the event lasted 3 hours. We shall eventually hear all panellists in this 5-part series on Australian space policy. Now let's listen again to Joel Patterson's introduction to Owen Mace.
First we've got Owen Mace. Owen Mace was part of the Australis Oscar 5 team and has graduated from the University of Melbourne with an electronics engineering degree and a PhD, and then became a lecturer in the Physics Royal Australian Air Force Department. He spent the second half of his working life in private industry and is now retired.
And just a reminder that Australis Oscar 5 was the first satellite to be built in Australia, although it was the second to be launched into space. ResatOne 1 was launched from Woomera in South Australia on 1967, November 29. Oscar 5, otherwise known as Australis A, was launched from Vandenberg, California in 1970 on January the 23rd, after many postponements. Now, Owen Mace.
Well, I suppose I would have to be considered the sort of grandfather, the old man of this presentation. So it's certainly going to come from a historical viewpoint. But first of all, I'd like to start with a little story for you. True story, by the way. And I think it tells a very powerful story about Australians' attitudes to ourselves. Now, I'll explain why I think that's important in due course. In the early 80s, 1980s, that is, not 1880s, as you might think from me, in the early 1880s, a couple of us visited the government aircraft factory at Fisherman's Bend in Port Melbourne to look at some of their electronic systems. As we went through, we were taken into a room, and there was a sort of a tube sitting in a frame, not very impressive, but we were told that it was a hovering rocket. Hovering rocket? That's a bit silly, isn't it? I mean, don't rockets go up, hovering, or maybe go that way, but that seemed like a damn silly thing to do. Anyway, they told us, well, maybe not. It had been tested at Woomera Test Range in South Australia, where I live at the moment, and they successfully made it hover, move about, maintain altitude and move about. As I say, not all that useful, you'd have thought, but anyway. Well, the concept was developed despite Canberra's instructions to cancel the program. Yes, they did the testing despite being told not to. And it's now Australia's largest defence export, the Nulka hovering rocket, which is used to seduce incoming anti-ship missiles away from a ship. Kind of handy. There have been 1,000 of them made, and they're in service in the Australian, United States, and Canadian navies, and the US Coast Guard. As I say, the largest, I believe, the largest defence export. It's interesting, isn't it? Government had said no, and yet it turned out to be such a great success. I think it illustrates that in those days, and I think less so now, to be perfectly honest, in those days we didn't believe in ourselves. When I was young, for example, it was, and that was a long time ago, when I was young, it was felt that, I don't know, professional people had to go to England to, or as my grandmother called it, home. She was born here. We had to go home to get a broaden our experience, and many doctors, many dentists, lawyers and so on did exactly that, gained their real experience in Mother England. My father said to me, do you want to go to the university that I went to, Cambridge? I said, no, I'll come to this university, and frankly, I'm damn glad I did. So it does sadden me, though, that I've seen many missed opportunities through my working life. And where there's been significant Australian intellectual property created. I used to keep a list of such projects or such intellectual property, if you like, since lost in retirement. And it was a pretty sad tale of dozens, literally dozens of major projects. So what I do is ask people, who's the Australian manufacturer of aircraft black boxes? Can anyone name one? No. Right answer. The internet was a major contribution made by this university. I sent my first email either 1979 or 1980 from this university because the computer department were heavily engaged in the development of the internet. In fact, Australia's internet connection to the world equals the US was from a microvax in a building, just that white building, which is now design or something. So there are lots of intellectual property. Oh, how about ultrasound images? Australian. Photocopiers. PET scanners. And also, CSIRO did some major work in gigahertz communications in buildings. Wi-Fi, in other words. So, let's look at some of the attempts to do something with this Australian intellectual property. As an undergraduate of this university, I was a member of a team that built an amateur radio satellite called Australis Oscar 5. Now, I have to say, we were pretty naive. That's not true. We were hopelessly naive and didn't know that you couldn't do these sorts of things. It just could not be done. So we did. And some of the things we did were pretty outrageous. Launching balloons from the physics building, which is not there, no, it's a different building now, and the Civil Aviation Authority. We did have presence of mind to wait for the wait for aircraft to pass through. Essendon was the airport then. So we did that until the Civil Aviation Authority, whatever they were called, called us one day and suggested that we might like to launch our balloons outside of protected airspace, so we did. So that was, for me, a really exciting time. At about the same time, the Weapons Research Establishment, now the Defence Science and Technology Group, I think it's called these days, built the RESAT, which was launched from Woomera. I was involved in quite a number of semi-space projects on using large scientific balloons, and at one time we held the altitude record, 48 kilometres, and the duration record, something like 2 weeks. These are not small payloads, by the way. Don't think that they're a little payload. These were a couple of hundred kilos and more. It was an Australian that co-invented the long-track scanning radiometer instrument, which measures particularly sea surface temperatures. And so that gives, if you can do that over the entire Earth, gives a good measure of the heat balance of the Earth and temperature. Kind of useful now in these days of that climate change has been discovered. An Aussie did that. Likewise, a CSIRO scientist invented the atmospheric oxygen pressure sensor, which measured surface pressure from space. The interesting thing about that was that I knew them both while I was studying, doing my PhD just behind here in what's now the Sydney Meyer Arts Centre. Ian Potter Arts Centre. Space is an interesting place because one of the things I did when I was working in private industry was to suggest that maybe we in Australia could produce the laser retroreflectors on then the, well, let me check, on the OSAT's second generation communication satellites. So indeed we had a man, a very, very clever, very experienced, very skilled optical man by the name of Bill James, lived in Melbourne, made these incredibly accurate corner reflectors that flew on the satellite, on the OSAT second generation satellite. So you see, space projects carry not just the traditional things of electronics and communications and so on, but a lot more, right into optics, and really state-of-the-art optics too. I was involved with proposing an X-ray satellite, astronomical satellite. Also, while I was at this university, a colleague and I, well, government was asking for big projects, major projects that we Australia could do, complete successfully, and show the world what we were capable of. We didn't propose one, we proposed two. One was a space tug, which was sort of in vogue then, and the idea was that it would autonomously go and pick up a satellite, bring it back to shuttle or make it burn up or whatever was required. The other was something you may have heard of, the Cape York's launch site. So unfortunately, nothing came of either, other than a lot of hot air and consultants' reports on the Cape York launch site. Never mind. FedSat. FedSat is a fairly recent satellite that was built by CSIRO and universities. And at the time I was on the board of the board of management of the, I was actually chairman of the Institute for Telecommunications Research, which was responsible for the, in South Australia, University of South Australia, which was responsible for the communications. More on that in a bit. In something like 15 years ago, NASA came to Australia suggesting that we might like to pay for an astronaut to fly on space shuttle. As an incentive, a little bit of a carrot, they were offering us, Australia, to design and build and supply the cabin lighting for the crew vehicle to go up to the space station. Not very exciting, you might think. Lighting, boring, who cares? Well, no, this was early days of LED lighting. Early days indeed. So if we'd picked that up and we'd made an industry out of that, Australia could have been supplying lighting to every modern airliner. Every modern airliner. Now, that's slightly more than just a few LEDs, clever LEDs in a capsule. I was also, for my manifold sins, and manifold they were, a member of the, have to read it, I'm afraid, International Space Advisory Committee of the Department of Industry, Science and Technology that advised the Department of Industry, Science and Technology and the Prime Minister on a putative space program. A considerable amount of econometric work or data was put together to show that it would benefit the country, but it didn't happen, as we know. We played host to numerous NASA and ESA tracking stations, and that will have resulted, has resulted in numbers of Australians, might even have been me at one stage, gaining experience in very fancy electronics, communications and so on. So to me, these are lost opportunities. And in many respects, it's not just the space industry that we've not built up, but it's other industries that are of comparable complexity, need for development of intellectual property that can then be used to further develop the industry. We don't have an electronics industry to speak of in this country. We were, at one stage, National Semiconductor was still around, but they're a major microelectronic, absolutely premium microelectronics company. And they offered to put in a microelectronics fabrication plant in Australia, which at that stage was the only continent in the world without such a plant. It didn't go ahead. Aircraft, government aircraft factory, designed a wonderful aircraft, the Nomad. It certainly had a lot of unique features and state-of-the-art features about it. I think I've got time. I was at Avalon Airfield one time, and we're going out to see a test flight of the Nomad, and going out on the runway following the aircraft, and there's a ploughed up field next to the in the grass next to the bitumen, the runway. And I said to our host, "What on earth is that?" You said, "That's dangerous, having a ploughed up field next to the runway, isn't it? A plane might go into it." "No," he casually answered, "that's where we test the rough field landing and takeoff of Nomad." Making the point that it was really quite a unique aircraft in its day. It was built for Australian conditions, of course. Short takeoff and landing, rough field aircraft with some unique aeronautical features, which I won't bore you with. So What about other countries, countries that we might compare ourselves with? Canada's is a comparable country, I would suggest. Yes, bigger population, 50% bigger or thereabouts. But think about it, it's got lots of unusable space. It's not quite desert, but a country with population centres like Australia. Well, Canada has Bombardier, which is the largest, third or fourth largest aircraft manufacturer, civil aircraft manufacturer in the world. Yes, it has a space program, about $300 million Canadian dollars a year. Bombardier, by the way, also makes trains, and it exports trains to, one guess, Australia. They also export to Europe, high-speed trains to Europe. Brazil's another interesting country. Perhaps less like Australia, but its middle classes are about the same size. And it has a company which vies with Bombardier for the third, fourth largest civil aviation company. Embraer makes aircraft, which sells to, yes, Australia. And it also has a space industry and launches its own satellites. So, and if you look up on Ask Mrs. Google, she will tell you that about 70 countries have space agencies. 70 countries have space. No, we're not one of them. So why is it? Well, here's my personal opinion. First, as I started saying, I don't think that Australians in general, and I'm talking from experience in proposing projects to government at all levels, federal, state and local, governments in Australia don't trust us to develop new stuff. Far better than we say, oh look, we'll pluck something out of the US, pluck something out of Europe or wherever, and that'll do us. And not prepared to take the risk. I don't seem to have our tall puppy syndrome. And I don't think that the importance of intellectual property within this country is understood. The Nomad, the plans for the Nomad and all that intellectual property, the Nomad aircraft, is now owned by Gippsland Aero, which is owned by an Indian company. Now, let me use an example that's relevant to a South Australian, the submarines. Yes, somebody groaned, and I'm not surprised. We bought a Swedish submarine. Damn good submarine, I might say. But we didn't have the right to the intellectual property to develop it further. And so now, you may have heard, we're going to buy a French submarine. We're going to buy a French submarine that's nuclear-powered, and then we'll spend 10 years fiddling with the design to turn it into a conventional submarine. Here's the conspiracy theorist coming out in me. Do you think it might actually be nuclear in the air? Never mind, don't ask that question. So, should we have a... No, surely not. Should we have a space industry? Well, here's my answer, and you guys, I'm sure, will talk to this and shoot me down, perhaps. Yes, but a space industry by itself, I don't think will succeed. I think we need the complementary industries and electronics, aviation, software, decent software industry that's doing decent things. That's not to say there aren't software companies around. I used to work for one that was 4,500 people, Australian software company. It's since been destroyed. So, you know, Sweden can do it. Think of IKEA. Think of Volvo and other companies. A friend of mine's just come back from the Volvo factory. He said it was full of robots making Volvo engines. They can do it. They're a little bit smaller than us too. So what is it that, what should we be doing? Well, I think, again, South Australia provides a good model. In the 50s, I think it was, Sir Thomas Playford, the longest serving premier of any state in the world, in any democratic state in the world, nearly 30 years, he realised the importance of industry, and of course his ideas were from the 50s and 60s, so he got the car industry going, electricity, he nationalised, and water, housing for people working in these industries. So, sure, those, an oil refinery. So those industries fired and fueled South Australia for many years, 30 years, maybe more. Of course, those industries now are in, or some of them are in decline. No oil refinery. Holden's going shortly. But the thought of developing, you know, an important industry for the future, something that's going to carry us forward, create intellectual property upon which we can then build, is something that I think we should be doing. I'll finish up by saying that when I was in private industry, I reckon, as a rule of thumb, and there's background to this, but not time, as a rule of thumb, for every dollar spent on initial R&D, you would need to, in coming up with a concept, you'd spend roughly $10 on getting it to a production item, and something like $100 to get it out into the marketplace, ready to be sold in quantity or whatever in the marketplace. So my question, therefore, from that is, if that's anywhere like realistic, you've got to have the intellectual property, of course. But Mr. Canberra, Mrs. Canberra, what is more valuable? A dollar in R&D tax concession or more customers? I think most companies would say the latter. So I leave you with those thoughts. Thank you for listening to me. And I'll be interested to hear what the other guys have to say. Thank you.
That was Owen Mace, who was a member of the team that built the Australis Oscar 5 amateur radio satellite at Melbourne University. Owen now lives in South Australia. You're listening to The Space Show. Now let's return to the launch of the Space Policy White Paper by the Australian Space Industry Association. Alice Gorman is Director of Studies in the Department of Archaeology at Flinders University in Adelaide. She is speaking here in her role as an Advisory Council member of the Space Industry Association of Australia. She gave a quick history of Australian involvement in space.
Australia, as many people know, has had a really strong and proud history in space exploration. Immediately after the Second World War, we were one of the first countries in the world to set up a rocket launch range from which space rockets could be sent into Earth orbit, and this was in collaboration with the UK. We've had very strong histories of collaboration with NASA on the Mercury, Gemini, Apollo and Apollo Soyuz programs, and we still work very closely with them today. We also collaborated with the precursor of the European Space Agency, an organisation called ELDO, in developing a rocket that could launch satellites into Earth orbit. So we have we've been around and very active in the space industry basically since it began immediately after the Second World War, and we have world-class assets. We have the Woomera rocket launch range in South Australia. We have incredible expertise in spacecraft and satellite tracking through a number of our tracking stations. Perhaps the most well-known are the ones based outside Canberra, currently tracking deep space spacecraft, and the Honeysuckle Creek tracking station, now defunct, had its 50th anniversary just the other day. It was the first place to receive Apollo 11 images. Despite this incredible history and heritage in space industry and space science, we've always just drawn back at the moment when it becomes serious. There's been several proposals to have an Australian Space Agency in the past, but and there's been a number of initiatives that have been quite successful, like setting up our Space Activities Act 1988, our Satellite Utilisation Policy, and we currently have the Space Coordination Office. But we've always just pulled back short of setting up a space agency. And the current world is one where we can no longer do that. We are so reliant on free data and access to space from our numerous close friends and allies in space, but we can't guarantee that we will be able to continue to access that data. Commercial and private space enterprises are becoming more and more dominant in the space world. And yet their clients are still often national space agencies. In Australia, we're developing a very vibrant startup culture, and we're drawing on both the deep expertise we have from programs and personnel from the past and all of the new space players that are coming forward to really allow these space companies an opportunity to grow. We need an environment that can sustain them. We need a space agency that international collaborators know they can come straight to get information, to get contacts, to get in, to find out how to work with Australian industries and Australian universities. Currently, we don't have that capacity. People, international agencies and companies come to us and they don't know where to go. There's no immediate port of call, and there's no capacity to collaborate or treat with other space agencies as equals. This is something that it's very timely to change. We have the history, we have the capacity, the capability and the expertise, and it would be fantastic if the International Astronautical Congress, which is being held here in September, as already mentioned, could be the catalyst for Australia truly stepping up onto the global stage with our space expertise.
Alice Gorman bringing to a close the first episode of this five-part series of Space Show programs on Australian space policy. It was researched, written and produced by Andrew Rennie of the Space Association of Australia. Well, I'm Andrew Rennie. On panel this evening, we have had Jay, and coming up on the future space shows, we have got, say, the politics ones for the next 4 weeks. And then on May the 31st and May 7th, we're looking at Australis Oscar 5, that first built Australian satellite. In a few moments, Nick Black and Purple Haze.